Wait for it, wait for it. Welcome to the BerlinBrigade.com podcast with your host, David Guerra.
Hallo, ich bin David Guerra und willkommen auf der 45. Folge der BerlinBrigade.com podcast. Hello, I'm Dave Guerra, and welcome to the 45th episode of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. I am a former member of Alpha Company, 6th Battalion, 502nd Infantry, Berlin Brigade, U.S. Army. And I thank you for taking the time to join me today on this, the greatest podcast ever, and exclusively dedicated to all the men and women that ever served in and supported the mission of the United States Army's most illustrious and most prestigious unit, the Berlin Brigade and the Berlin Command. So, without any further delay, los geht's mit diesem Podcast.
Take your seats because it's time for the special guest interview.
Joining us today is the one and only Mark Valley. Mark served with the Berlin Brigade as a member of the 42nd Engineer Company from July of 1989 to early 1991, when he went to participate in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and then later returned back to Berlin and worked at DEH, Berlin Brigade Headquarters, and ETS in October of 1992. Mark is also a 1987 graduate of the United States Military Academy with a degree in mathematics, aside from being, and well, also a Desert Storm veteran. Well, we mentioned that. But wait, there's more. Currently, Mark is better known as Richard Oliver, attorney on the hit NBC show Harry's Law, starring not only Mark, but Kathy Bates, Christopher McDonald, and a cast of awesome actors and actresses. And if you haven't seen it, well, the time is now. But we'll talk about Harry's Law in a few. And so, Mark, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Dave. It's a pleasure.
Before we really, really get started, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you went to school. Obviously, we know you went to the military academy, but right. Where else? Where are you from, where you went to school, and what did you do to get to Berlin?
Well, I came from a small town in upstate New York called Ogdensburg. It's right on the Canadian border. And, I don't know if that had anything to do with ending up in an international place like Berlin, but it was a pretty remote place on the Canadian border. We used to joke around that we had an international airport, which could land very small planes from Canada, essentially. But anyway, I went to West Point and I branched in engineers, but I went to, initially I was stationed in West Germany in Mainz with the 8th Infantry Division, which doesn't exist anymore, but I lived in a little wine village along the Rhine called Oppenheim and started learning German while I was there. And I think I was there for about a year and a half, and I got a call from a company commander in Berlin saying that they were going to have an opening for a lieutenant, and he'd gotten a recommendation from me from some course I'd been through, and wanted to know if I'd like to go to Berlin. And I was pretty excited about it. So, every once in a while in the Army, it's possible to do what you want to do. Once you start putting paperwork through, sometimes they approve things. So it worked out. Apparently, there was a lieutenant there before me who was leading a convoy, I think in 1988, through the corridor from Helmstedt to Berlin. And at some point, I mean, remember that? You had to go through there, and they gave you these Motorola radios that were the size of, like, footlockers, and give you a very detailed map with a binder with pictures and everything of where to turn and so forth. Well, apparently they were moving part of their unit back from an exercise, maybe Bergen-Belsen or something, and they were coming back through, and apparently this lieutenant took a wrong turn and essentially began like a one platoon invasion of East Germany, and put the Russians on alert, and everybody got excited about that. So he was fired, and they replaced him with me. So I arrived in I think it was July of 1989 to Berlin.
Wow, you got there just in time for some awesome stuff was happening all around you at that time, and yeah. I could see why the Soviets would be a little edgy, especially during that time.
Yeah, things were pretty tense then. I mean, it was around that time in August and September when some of the larger demonstrations were going on, like in Leipzig and Dresden, where they had like, you know, 300,000, 400,000 people showing up at an outdoor demonstration, which was just an incredible amount of people. And that was shortly after Ronald Reagan had said, you know, take down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev, and so forth. So it was a pretty interesting time. I remember going over there before the wall came down, you know, in uniform. You had to wear your Class A uniform, and you had to be back by midnight, and you had to go through Checkpoint Charlie. And I remember walking around East Berlin before it all came down, which is very kind of ghostly quiet. I mean, soldiers used to go over there and try to buy, like, feather blankets and china and things, but there wasn't much for sale on the markets there. Things were pretty quiet. But you could go to the top of the top of that tower, to that restaurant there, and have a fantastic meal for the equivalent of, like, $5 American. I remember that. But it was an interesting experience meeting Russians, especially my first trip through the corridor. I had an old BMW and just about everything I owned stashed into that car. And yeah, I mean, even having gone through West Point and, you know, training, you know, the enemy was the, you know, the Warsaw Pact nations, and those were the people that we were planning on fighting. And it was bizarre meeting the Russians face to face at those checkpoints as you were driving through, and then going and waiting in their little waiting area. I remember They used to watch you while you were sitting in the waiting room, waiting for your flag orders to be processed. And they had some pretty low tech surveillance equipment. I remember sitting in this room, and it was wood paneling, and they had some magazines on the coffee table, you know, some light reading by, like, Joseph Stalin and you know, Vladimir Lenin. And I remember there being a slot in the wall. And this little horizontal, like, 6-inch slot in the wall, and every once in a while, these two eyes would show up in it. that was their way of keeping an eye on you. They would just kind of look through this little slot in the wall while you're waiting for your papers to be approved, and then, you know, onward back into the country. But I digressed a little bit. I'm not sure where I was, but go ahead.
No, and it's good. It's one of those. You're telling us a side that we, on the podcast, I haven't talked to somebody yet, but that I'm working on it. Somebody who's actually worked at Helmstead and was doing this on a day-to-day basis. So it's neat to get this new perspective. Now, I guess it's going to be a segue to another interview, and hopefully somebody out there will say, hey, yeah, I was at Helmstead. Let's talk about it. And Mark was right on. And so hey, you're leading us to the next podcast interview, which is a good thing. So, no, you did not digress. You moved us forward.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So you got to Berlin, and you replaced this lieutenant who decided he wanted to invade East Germany. It's kind of almost like I'm thinking about it, but it didn't really happen. You know, the thing when stripes, when they go into Czechoslovakia. Hey, it's like going to Wisconsin.
So I went to McNair Barracks and had my in processing, and yeah, I remember meeting my company commander and him showing me a map of Berlin, and I went out for a jog, and I hadn't gone very far. We were not at McNair. We were stationed in Finkenstein, LA, in those little barracks right there that used to be a former Prussian military academy at one time. But I just went out for a jog and thinking, well, I'll run along this little canal right here. It looks like a good place. And I remember noticing just across the canal, there were these big towers, and the guys were wearing uniforms in a kind of bright shade of green that I wasn't used to seeing. And they're, you know, they had a wood stock on their rifles. And I thought, oh my God, these are AK-47s. And, oh my gosh, this is the Berlin Wall. And it wasn't always a wall, the Berlin Wall. I mean, sometimes it was, yeah, like a canal and then a smaller wall with some barbed wire. But there were these watchtowers right along the canals down in the American sector that were pretty up close and intimate, if I remember correctly. So I was sent back. My unit had deployed to Bergen-Belsen. I can't remember. I think it was Bergen-Belsen. They deployed there, and I had to go. I had to meet up with them. So I got on the duty train, and everybody remembers that duty train. It was just this fantastic, cheap ride all the way into all the way into Frankfurt. But I had to get off at Helmstedt, actually. I remember an NCO who had worked on the train had come through, and I was in my you know, BDUs, and I had a pack, I had my M16, and you know, I had my, you know, full gear to go out with my unit that was doing maneuvers out in the field. And the sergeant came and woke me up, and he said, "Hey, Lieutenant, next stop is Helmstedt," and I, or the one that I had to get off on, I couldn't remember. I think it was Helmstedt, and I thought he said this was your stop at Helmstedt. So he walked away down the hall, and I got up, and I'm sort of half awake and a little bit groggy, and I throw my pack on, I grab my M16, and walk down the. I get off the train, and I walk onto the platform. And I take a look, and there's nobody there. It's quiet. There's that sort of dim lighting that they used to have in East Germany everywhere where it seems like they couldn't afford real lights. I remember looking at some of the signage at the train station, and some of it was in this kind of strange scroll. Maybe it was Cyrillic. I wasn't sure. And I look down to my left, and I see down to my left a guy with a brown overcoat that went about to his calves. And he had a black furry hat on, and he had one of those rifles with the wooden stock. I'd realized quickly that I'd just gotten off the train a little bit too early, and this was a Russian guard. So I essentially invaded East Germany myself, completely alone. And the train was starting to make noises like it was taking off again, and I just kind of quickly ran back to the train and got on, decided not to invade East Germany myself. So, but anyway, that was my story. Got back on the train, and it actually was the next stop that was Helmstedt. So I got off the train one stop before Helmstedt, and this Russian was coming at me pretty quickly, so I got back on the train, and I was good to go.
Trial by fire. So another lieutenant might have been replaced.
That came to World War III, I guess.
Yeah, so just on the verge of replacing another lieutenant, I see.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow. So it sounds like you made it to your unit. Everything's okay. You're full swing with the Berlin Brigade. Well, now let's fast forward a little bit and tell us about how you ended up in Desert Storm.
Well, Desert Storm had kicked the Desert Shield had sort of kicked off first with the Air Force. And at the time, they were saying, well, they were going to send, one unit from like some units from 7th Corps. They actually were going to send the unit that I had just left and down in Mainz, and 8th ID was going. But there wasn't any talk of anybody from Berlin going, because we said, well, why would they use a unit that specializes in urban warfare? This is going to be this can be a huge desert war with mechanized units clashing out in the desert. And so we felt we were pretty safe in Berlin. But at some point they thought this was going to be a much heavier conflict, and they realized at some point that they were probably going to need some replacement troops. So there kind of was an issue that went down to U.S. Army Europe saying they needed so many troops to go out there as replacement soldiers. And it just sort of trickled down. I mean, from our battalion, they needed 30. And I was just selected as an officer to go with them. And, I wasn't really too excited about going at the time. I remember I was kind of enjoying life in Berlin, and I was planning on getting out of the army as well. And I remember them saying, well, if we don't send you, Mark, we'll send Lieutenant so-and-so. And I thought, he was like a young lieutenant, just had a kid. And I thought, oh, great. You know, if something happens to him, I'll be hating myself the rest of my life. So I went and served my country. And it ended up being, as you can imagine, if you got an order from your unit to send 20 guys as replacement troops, as often happened, most of the soldiers that were sent weren't necessarily like the best, most motivated guy. I think it almost seemed like the qualifications you had to have is most of the guys seemed to have Article 15s or multiple ones. So essentially it was like the Dirty Dozen was the group that I was kind of sent off with to Saudi Arabia. And at the time we were getting there, and they didn't really know what to do with us. They put us in Khobar Towers, which became famous 5 years later when Al-Qaeda blew it up. But at that time, it was a really large settlement it was really just a big place for American transportation and some replacement troops. They realized pretty quickly some of the transportation units, some of the civilian drivers were refusing to drive any farther once the Iraqis started launching Scud missiles back into Dhahran and Dammam in that area. So they had to do something with this. So they ended up forming transportation units out of it. And I was sent to a unit, ironically, that had German manuals because they thought I could translate them. Because I've been stationed in Berlin and I'd learned some German and I had it on my record. So I was sent to a unit that had Tetra trucks from East Germany that were donated by the Germans for the war effort. And it didn't take much to say, okay, this is the clutch, this is the brake. It was pretty much the same thing. And I worked as a transportation platoon leader, just like a convoy leader throughout the, leading up to the 4-day war and then probably for about a month or two afterwards as they kind of cleaned things up. And then I ended up going back to Berlin and decided to work at DEH, which at that time was just mostly, they were doing a lot of renovations of American facilities. I think I renovated the basketball gym at McNair, the floor. I was in charge of that project, and we did a renovation on the bowling alley there as well. And there was another renovation at Teufelsberg that I worked on, and so it was an interesting job working mostly with Germans.
Oh, pretty cool. So you got to see the sites.
Yeah, all the hot spots.
Yeah, good deal. Good deal. Well, it's like with all of us, all good things must come to an end, and your time at Berlin came to an end. It didn't really come to an end. You hung around there, or you came to the States and it went back.
Yeah, I wanted to get what they called an overseas out. I'm forgetting what they called it. I just wanted to be discharged in Berlin, but they said no. They didn't want to do that. So I went back to Fort Dix, New Jersey, and out processed. This was in October. And I wasn't really sure what I was going to do, but I had worked as an extra on a movie called The Innocent with Anthony Hopkins. And, I'd actually taken leave from my unit, headquarters unit, which I was assigned to while I was working at DH. And I took about 3 weeks leave from that to work on this movie, and I felt like, wow, this would be something interesting to do. I felt like I wanted to join the circus, so I found a German acting teacher in Schöneberg, and I would go to classes twice a week, and in German, which was kind of an experience. I mean, I spoke to the guy maybe 6 or 7 years ago. He talks how strange it was having this American soldier show up in his acting class after the wall had come down. And I ended up going back to New Jersey, out processing, coming back to Berlin as a civilian and kind of sleeping on people's couches until, my hair started growing a little bit longer. And then the word was out. I think word was spread at the staff meeting that said there's this ex-officer with long hair who is trying to be an actor. And they just sort of put it out through the chain of command that no one should be harboring him. It just, I don't know, I seemed un-American or something, I don't know. So I was basically kicked off of the American sector. I was staying with another lieutenant. He had an extra room. And they made a little announcement that it wouldn't be good for his career if he was harboring this, this guy who's trying to be an actor. So, I ended up, sleeping on a series of couches for a few months. And I had a German acting teacher who told me, he said, Mark, it's time for you to go to New York and start studying acting there with your people. So that's what I did in 1993.
Wow, I'm looking here on the Internet Movie Database, and I pulled up your page on there. And folks, the link will be on the show notes, so don't worry. And I see you've run a gamut of shows. I mean, some of the greatest shows of on television, ER, Boston Legal, CSI, and of course the show you're on now, Harry's Law. Wow, I mean, it's an impressive list.
Yeah, I've been pretty fortunate. I've done a lot of work in television, and I've been pretty fortunate with that. I moved to Los Angeles to work on a soap opera called Days of Our Lives, and I did that for a couple of years. And afterwards, I had a couple of lean years afterwards where I couldn't really find much work. But, I just continued to go to acting classes and continued to you know, meet with other teachers and to constantly try to improve my craft. And at some point, I just started working fairly consistently in television series. And yeah, right now I'm working on for David Kelly again for Harry's Law on Harry's Law.
On Days of Our Lives, everybody, Mark played Jack Devereaux. Yeah, he was Jack Devereaux was one of those very popular characters on daytime television, and Mark played that character. And I'm not too sure, but if he died or what happened. But then again, Jack Devereaux is always dying on television soap operas. That's just the way of soap opera. Anyway, but now that we're talking about movies and television, tell us, how does the military way of life, you know, that structured military way of life, vary from the movie and television way of life, or that structured way of life?
Well, it was an interesting transition. I've met quite a few veterans now who are transitioning into civilian life, and I can identify with some of their feelings. I mean, the Army, an awful lot was asked of you, but also an awful lot was provided. There were things you didn't really have to worry about. One was finding a job or getting a place to live, or you know, knowing how are you going to deal in this world of civilians? How are you going to live in this world of civilians? It seems that everything is a little bit different. You know, people seem to be a little bit more out for themselves than you know, looking out for the person next to them. And you know, there's a lot of concerns that a lot of these guys and challenges that these guys face. And I remember those back then, and I remember at the time thinking, God, how am I gonna, you know, I want to be an actor. How am I going to do this? And I think part of my naivete sort of helped me out. I remember thinking, well, if I wanted to be a ranger, you got to go to ranger school, you know. So I've always felt that, you know, if I wanted to be an actor, I had to go to school for it, to work at it, and that's paid off for me. You know, to be honest with you, it's been that's my dog. I got a good watchdog here. Rudy, quiet down. Anyway, I've been pretty fortunate, and you know, there's some things that are pretty similar to being in the Army. I was mentioned to somebody before that being an actor, I didn't realize it, but you know, people are telling you there's a script where you're told what to say, and with some exceptions, they pretty much tell you what to wear, when to show up, which is usually very early in the morning. They have call sheets, and you know, the way that they plan any type of television or film shoot is an awful lot like a military operation. Everyone has a really specific job that they have to do, and you know, the timing and is very important, and competence is very important because there's a lot of money involved usually. So you know, you often see some people working really, really well together under some pretty extreme circumstances. But back to acting, I mean, you're kind of told what to say, how to say it, where to say it, what to wear, when to show up, when to do it. And it's, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I don't know how you could be in the Army. I could never have anybody tell me what to do. And I think, well, this is kind of, there's some real similarities here, you know. I mean, nobody's shooting at us, obviously, and as an actor. So, you know, so there's that difference, but you know, there's quite a few similarities I found.
Okay. Oh, okay. So aside from Harry's Law, are you doing anything now or something we should be looking out for in the near future?
Well, I think if you just keep an eye on my Twitter site, Yes Mark Valley, I'm trying to keep people posted. I'm just making some appearances and doing stand-up comedy at you know, some smaller venues right now. And there's that. There's a movie that's also coming out called Stolen with Nicolas Cage. It should be coming out in the spring or the summer. I'm not sure. Yeah, probably early summer. And that should be coming out. I play an FBI agent with who's trying to catch Nicolas Cage, which is a lot of fun. And what else? Yeah, that's about it for right now.
Oh, pretty cool. Stand-up comedy, what got you into that?
Well, I guess the same thing anybody gets into it. You know, I like to perform. I like to tell jokes. I like to get on stage, and yeah, I guess you just have to come see it and check it out.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. Where can we see you?
Even when I was in the Army, I was always the one kind of, you know, impersonating officers and cracking jokes, and you know, it's just one of those natural things. It's always sort of been part of me.
Gotcha, gotcha. And where can somebody see you now on your comedy?
Like I said, stand-up? Follow the Twitter. Once I start getting some bigger venues, then I'll let you know.
Cool.
But mostly it's more or less a hobby that I'm doing right now until it turns into something large.
Wow, good deal. And I was reading also, and again, to that Internet Movie Database, that's an awesome website. I was reading that you had penned a one-man show, Walls, Wars, and Whiskey. Is this kind of an offtake on that, or is this a continuation of that, or...?
It was something that I did. It was a one-man show. It was sort of why I went into the Army. You know, my grandfather was there, and, you know, it was in World War II, and I'm actually going to Normandy to trace part of his footsteps. He landed at Utah Beach shortly after D-Day, and my father and I are going to walk around and go where he went. And but anyway, it started out with, you know, having, you know, some family in the military, and you know, then, you know, my experience at West Point, and, you know, being kind of shaped in the generation by Vietnam, although I was obviously too young to go. I had some uncles who were drafted, and it was also on television quite a bit. I mean, it was a pretty heavy period of time to be growing up and watching all that going on, at least watching it on television. So, you know, there was that sort of formative years, like why I went into the Army, and then what I did in Berlin. It was fun. I played a variety of different characters, a dozen different characters, from, you know, a crazy bartender in Berlin, and then when the wall came down, what happened after that, and, you know, my experience in the Gulf War, and then ultimately, you know, leaving the Army, and what I did after that. So it's basically why I went into the Army, what I did, and why I got out.
Should be interesting. Is there any video of this that we could see someplace, or is that just, you know?
No, I got an old VHS tape, and the sound isn't that good, and I need to kind of put it back together again. And I also sort of combined some experiences from other people as well, so it wasn't just, you know, my own personal experience as well. I'm thinking about trying to, you know, get it digitalized and then download it. Once I ever get a website for myself, I'll be able to put it on there.
Yeah, those websites. Everybody needs one.
Perform it again or something. Who knows? But Scott, it was just an immense amount of work playing a lot of different characters. But it was a lot of fun. It was about an hour long. I did it and performed it in L.A. and at a Fringe Festival and then in my hometown for a benefit.
Oh, cool. Well, that should be interesting. So, yeah, definitely let us know if you get it digitized, because it'd be something to – and those of us that were in Berlin will definitely – we'll understand. We know what you're talking about. So that's good. Okay, well, now let's take it back to Berlin a little bit, or not necessarily back in time, but, you know, we all leave and we all have an impression of the city and everything, and you were there during that unique time when it was still divided, and then it wasn't divided, and that's pretty cool. But what's the one thing you do miss about the city of Berlin and being in Berlin?
Yeah, interesting. Well, of course I was younger then, you know, and, you know, I mean, I could say I miss being, you know, being in my 20s sometimes, but, I think for the most part, what I miss about it is that it just was like a crossroads at the time. There was, you know, I mean, there's always been this difference between like the East and the West. And I think then it wasn't necessarily the Oriental East. It was more like Eastern Europe and the West. And there just seemed to be this crossroad of ideas and thought. And at that crossroads and at that frontier, you know, between friend and enemy, it just seemed like so many things were possible. It was just such an exciting place. I miss that. I mean, some other things I miss about it. I mean, Berlin is a fantastic city. There's so many beautiful parks there, and they're so well kept and still feel sort of like wilderness. I mean, Hüttenweg and Grunewald are some beautiful spots. And I just remember being able to get on a train and drive into Schöneberg or go into like the Cafe Einstein, which I heard is still there. And, you know, some of the other clubs that would just be open all night. And, and sort of the feeling that anything goes there. There's also a little bit of, know, there's kind of a decadent side to Berlin back then, you know, and I think that's always been there for a while. And, you know, this is kind of freedom of thought and ideas and, you know, kind of an encouragement of people to kind of express themselves. And it really sort of inspired me as a young soldier to realize, wow, there are some very interesting ways to live. You can be an artist, you can be a writer, you can be so many different things besides a soldier. And I guess I really remember kind of learning there and thinking, wow, it's just as exciting to risk really living as it is to risk dying for anyone. So that's what I miss about the place. You know?
And have you been back since then?
Yes, I've been back a couple of times, actually. You know, I go back, I still have a couple of friends there. I'll go visit and I'll drive around and look at what's happened and what's going on. I think the last time I was there, I walked around Nollendorf. It was a Nollendorf plot. Yeah, some of the areas are really pretty much the same. But, of course, you know, going into East Berlin, that's obviously much different. I like to go and get a cab driver who's you know, who's kind of seen the changes and seen how things have turned around to kind of show me around. But East Berlin, I mean, you know, Prenzlauer Berg is also, you know, that's their Williamsburg now. That's where all the hipsters hang out. And, you know, it used to just be like obviously an East German kind of working class area. So a lot of things obviously had changed. And I just love to go back and just check in. I also like I miss Berliners. I miss their sort of dark, but they have a kind of dark but dry sense of humor, and I miss that. I always thought that was a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, you can't escape them. Yeah, definitely. Wow. And when are you heading back?
When am I heading back? Where?
Back to Berlin.
Oh, back to Berlin. I don't know. I was thinking about going this year. I'm going to be in France probably in June. I thought, well, maybe I'll shoot over to Berlin if I'm in Europe. Maybe I'll head over there. God, I think the last time I was there was probably maybe 10 years ago.
Oh yes, you are way overdue.
So yeah, it's time for me to go back again. How about yourself? You been there much?
Last time I was there was in 2009 for the anniversary, the 20th anniversary.
And oh really?
Yeah, that was awesome. It was fantastic. I mean, while it wasn't like, you know, when you were there, when it was actually happening, but again, among, you know, 300,000 people and just live that moment. That was pretty cool. That was a lot of fun. And the change of that city, and it continues to change. That's why it'll just continue to be Berlin.
Yeah, I always felt like James Bond over there. You know, it was a great time. I guess some of my best friends are friends that I made when I was in Berlin. Soldiers of mine, and you know, it was a really, really intense time of life. And it's just a fantastic place. And I don't think there's really ever been any place like it.
So, oh yeah, definitely. We continue to find old friends, and it's like we just.
Why is it? I mean, why is it? Like a lot of people are stationed in certain places and they just sort of forget about it. But I mean, like, why do you have this podcast? What is it about Berlin for you that draws you back and makes you want to hold on to it or remember it?
Interesting question. Well, let's see. Well, for like, let's look at my wife. She was there in Berlin because of her father. So for her, she says Berlin was her childhood. And for me, it's where I grew up. It was my first assignment after basic. It's where I stopped being a kid and had to become a man. It's where it all became real.
Really much was the place. I mean, because America, we come from a pretty, you know, fairly protected place, if not geographically, then also ideologically. But there, suddenly, you're really face-to-face with some realities in life, you know?
And from the moment you get there, I mean, you knew what was real and what was important, and you definitely knew what was not.
Yeah. You know what it feels like to be in a place that's kind of real. I mean, in the Cold War, that's as close as you came to kind of being in a combat assignment. You know what I mean? I mean, without not counting like, you know, special operations troops and stuff like that. But I mean, even some of the people that I've met that were in Berlin that worked with some of the special operations, and they had there were some pretty interesting things going on there that I didn't know about at the time.
oh, some stuff is now just starting to come to light, and you know, you start listening to it and you hear it and you read about it, and you start looking at it from the perspective of now, and you say to yourself, hey, wait a minute, this is what was going on while I was there. I mean, it's definitely one of those times in history that, one, can never be repeated, and two, the people that were there for the same reason you were there. So everything just kind of fell into place, and it did. So I'm very hard-pressed to find any other situation since Berlin that comes close to dealing with the people that you dealt with on a daily, that we dealt with on a daily basis, and that's to include the citizens of Berlin. It was definitely unique.
And also, and you know, if you think about it, a lot of the wars that Americans have been in, and you know, they don't always have such a, that Berlin Wall coming down, really, I mean, granted, the East-West conflict with the Russians was, you know, I think it was containment that was really, I mean, there was only so long that that their type of economy could sustain itself. But, it was one place where, like American involvement had a happy ending, you know? And having been a part of that I'm proud of that.
Well, now we come to that point in the podcast where we need to start wrapping it up. And, Mark, any last words, comments, anything we didn't cover you want to make sure you get out there? I'll tell you what, the microphone's yours.
The microphone is mine. Well, you know, if I think of something else, I'll let you know. But right now, I think we've pretty much covered an awful lot. I mean, it was just a wonderful time in my life. Some of my best friends are, you know, I met there, and forget it. I'm looking forward to reading your book as well.
Okay, everybody. Well, listen, it's that time. We got to say goodbye to Mark Valley. Mark, thank you very much for joining us here. Hey, tell us, when can we see you on TV on Harry's Law?
Harry's Law, Sunday night at 8 p.m.
It's on NBC, everybody. And if you don't have it, then TiVo it or DVR it or whatever.
Check it out.
Yeah, definitely. And hey, it's a great show. Really like it. Great actress, Kathy Bates. How did you get this? I mean, it's an awesome show. And I'm not saying anything about yours, what you do. But what I'm saying is, like, man, it's to work with Kathy Bates. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Well, David Kelly's a fantastic writer. He wrote, a lot of shows like Ally McBeal and The Practice and Picket Fences and so forth. So he's a very prolific and talented writer who's always sort of, keeps his finger on the kind of pulse of current social issues that are kind of going on in the country right now. So I always like working for him. I worked in Boston Legal for a few years, and they were looking at adding a new character to Harry's Law last year, and some of the producers rumored me from Boston Legal, so they hired me back. So it was nice to get hired back by people that I've worked with before. And it's a real treat getting to work with Kathy Bates.
Big time, big time. Well, listen, continued success on your show, and hopefully gets picked up for another year, or has it been picked up for another season yet?
Don't know yet.
Okay. Well, hopefully by the time this airs, the answer is yes. Listen, Mark, thank you very much for your time. It's been greatly appreciated. Again, everybody, Mark Valley, former member, 42nd Engineers, from July of 89 to October of 92, Desert Storm veteran, graduate of the United States Military Academy, TV, movie, comedian, you name it. Mark, thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you, Dave.
Okay, everybody, as a postscript or a PS, as we mentioned at the end of the interview, that at the time we recorded the interview, it was not known whether Harry's Law was being picked up for another season. Unfortunately, it was not. However, that didn't stop Mark, because he kept going. He did that movie with Nicolas Cage and Stolen, so be on the lookout for that one. And he comes out in the most recent go get Osama bin Laden movie, Zero Dark Thirty. He plays a C-130 pilot. So if you see that movie, be on the lookout for a C-130 pilot. An Army guy playing an Air Force guy. I don't know if he can do it. I think he can. But you still will be able to see him on regular weekly television. He's going to star with the ever lovely, ever awesome, fantastic Dana Delaney in Body of Proof. And there he plays Detective Tommy Sullivan. And looking at his Internet Movie Database, his IMDb page, we see him coming out in at least 5 episodes. And so be on the lookout for that. And if I am correct, Body of Proof is on ABC. And on video, it's just a video, he comes out as, he's the voice of Superman or Clark Kent or Clark Kent and Superman in the Batman The Dark Knight Returns Part 2. This is a video. So it's one of those straight to video things. So again, be on the lookout for Mark Valley. He's got a lot of stuff going on. And as of early 2013, my understanding, he will be going to heading on over to Berlin. So if you're in the Berlin area, if you're in the city, be on the lookout. Mark Valley should be around. Other than that, thank you, Mark, for spending some time with us. Again, a very special thanks to Mark Valley, former member of the 42nd Engineer Company, July 1989 to early 1991, for joining us on the interview. Remember, you can follow Mark Valley on Twitter, and his sign is at Yes Mark Valley, and that'll be on the show notes and on the webpage. You can also see him as the C-130 aircraft pilot in the motion picture Zero Dark Thirty. And, of course, you can watch him every week on the hit television show Body of Proof on the ABC network. The third season of Body of Proof will premiere on Tuesday, February 19, 2013. So be sure to tune in and watch Mark Valley along with the always lovely and always talented Dana Delaney. Hey, speaking of movie stars and stuff, the Berlin International Film Festival begins the 7th of February and runs through the 17th in Berlin. So if you are in Berlin or know someone working at the Berlin Alley, see what you can do by getting us a t-shirt or a poster or something. It'd be kind of cool. Well, the time has come to start wrapping up this episode of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. As always, I invite you to call and leave a voice message or audio comment on the Berlin Brigade hotline at 413-274-4233. That's 413-BRIGADE. Also, don't forget, you can always send in your comments, concerns, questions, reunion information, and, of course, podcast ideas to Dave@BerlinBrigade.com. That's Dave@BerlinBrigade.com. If you want to get your message to the right audience, this podcast and the BerlinBrigade.com website is the perfect vehicle to communicate with your audience. So don't think your reunion is too small, because when two or more veterans get together, it's a reunion, and that is a great cause for celebration. So, hey, please drop me a note. Drop everybody a note and let us know what's going on. I also invite you to stay up to date with the latest at BerlinBrigade.com by following us on Twitter at www.twitter.com/BerlinBrigade, and Berlin Brigade is all one word. Also, be sure to check out the Facebook fan page. That's the latest social media tool that is now online and in use. And if you made it to this point of the podcast, I invite you to go to the fan page, and the link is on the BerlinBrigade.com homepage, and like us. Für unsere deutschen Zuhörer. Wenn Sie hören mir jetzt, ist dies für Sie. Was denkst du darüber, dass eine deutsche Version der BerlinBrigade.com Podcast? Bitte sagen Sie mir per E-Mail an dave@BerlinBrigade.com. Vielen Dank. Lastly, I want to say merci beaucoup. Thank you very much. Vielen Dank. Spasiba. To all the website visitors, and I do hope you have enjoyed your visit to Freedom's Virtual Outpost, and please come back real soon. Well, everyone, that's it for the 45th edition of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. I am your host, David Guerra. Thank you for spending this time with me, and I continue. No, we will always continue that quest for the key to the clock tower. And again, if you know who has it, come on, fess up. Anyway, listen, until next time, danke, auf Wiedersehen, tschüss.
Sergeant Major, dismiss the brigade! The BerlinBrigade.com podcast is a Dave Guerra production. Thank you.